From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. In this hour of Forum, fun with physics. UC Berkeley professor Richard Muller's book, Physics for Future Presidents, used science to explain the kinds of issues commanders-in-chief grapple with, from terrorism to energy independence. Well, now he's back with a new book called The Instant Physicist. It's full of fun facts and anecdotes describing the physics of things ranging from tsunamis and global warming to Botox and spy satellites. We'll talk with him and take your phone calls on Forum, and we'll get started right after this. And welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Dave Iverson. Well, physics is one of the world's oldest academic pursuits, and its principles influence a wide range of research, including nuclear science, geology, and many, many other topics. But a few years ago, UC Berkeley professor Richard Muller wrote the best-selling Physics for Future Presidents, explaining the physics theories relevant to things like terrorism, nuclear threats, global warming, the kinds of things presidents have to deal with. In his new book, The Instant Physicist, An Illustrated Guide, well, it's also full of anecdotes, color illustrations, and fun facts to explain things like why people can outrun tsunamis, even though the giant waves travel at 300 miles an hour, or why powerful spy satellites may never help catch Osama bin Laden. And Rich Muller joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Well, why write this book? What were you trying to do? What was your goal?
Well, I love to appeal to the people who normally stay away from physics and empower them, let them know that they can really understand this stuff. I think most people, even in my class at Berkeley, I find that half the students either hate physics or dread physics. They have had bad experiences. It's not their fault. It's the fault of the people who teach it. We teach it so badly. The fact is, physics is really important for our high-tech world. So many of our key decisions involve some level of physics. And the fact is, physics, this kind of physics, is something that everybody can understand. It's just a matter of making it accessible.
When you say it's badly taught, give us an example. What do you mean? Just that it's too theoretical or too what?
Well, typically it is shrouded in what I call the fog of math, that when you ask a physics professor some question and he doesn't have a good answer, he goes to the blackboard and writes an equation. Physics isn't math. Every physics professor knows that the problem they have when producing graduate students who will become the future physics researchers is to get them to forget the math for a moment. Think the physics. And in fact, stripping off the math really makes the physics accessible. The other thing, of course, is you go right to those issues that are really important. This really gets people excited. People want to know the answer to this thing. They're drawn like a moth to a flame, except I don't want it to be a flame. I want it to be a compact fluorescent light bulb so they don't get burned.
You know, before we began here, I was just saying that, I have a science-y background. I studied microbiology, organic chemistry, physiology, all that stuff. And I somehow avoided or just didn't take physics. Is that true? How common is that?
Extremely common. As I say, students learn that physics is a thing to stay away from. It gets mathematical right away, and it's terribly boring. The way radioactivity is typically taught is they start by talking about the nucleus and the particles they come out and give them the energies and the names and all that stuff. And only at the end do they get to the things that are really important, like how does radioactivity cause cancer? What happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki? What happened at Three Mile Island in Chernobyl? These are the things to start with. Once people—
To draw people in.
And because that's what's really important. And once they understand that, they often want to know what's the difference between an alpha particle and a beta ray.
Is it true that physics is generally more difficult to understand than, say, physiology because it is more theoretical?
I don't think so. I think it is taught that way. It's as if we only teach physics with the hope of inspiring more mini physicists. We don't teach other subjects that way. When we teach literature, we don't assume that everybody is going to become a professional novelist. Or if we teach philosophy, not everybody is going to become a philosopher. But we teach physics as if, here, let's start at the beginning and let's go slowly up. And some of you, of course, will stop after one semester. And that's too bad because you'll miss out on the best part. So I like to jump right to the best part. and get to that. I really believe that we need to have greater physics knowledge among our leaders, that on high-tech issues, everything from terrorism to nuclear weapons to global warming, we need our leaders to really understand these things, and they can.
Give us an example of why of the physics of global warming and why it would be important for a leader or future leader to know.
Well, let me actually give you a slightly different example. A student of mine came to me a year later to tell me she came to my office hour, even though she was no longer a student. She just had to see me because she had this wonderful experience. She had had dinner with her family, and they had invited over a physicist from Livermore. And he was working on controlled thermonuclear fusion. Okay, this is a new energy source that's going to replace everything and be wonderful, and you'll just take seawater and turn it into energy. And so he regaled them with stories about this. And then the student said, well, it was sort of quiet afterwards because what could you say? I mean, she knew a little bit about it, but he was a real expert. So she piped in and said, yeah, you know, that's wonderful. I think solar has a great future too, solar power. And she told me the physicist snickered. That's the term she used. Now, physicists are not necessarily the best, you know, the most adept socially. And this, unfortunately, was an example of that. And then he laughed and he said, you know, if you want enough solar power just to cover the state of California, you'd have to plaster the whole state with solar cells.
Yeah, well, in fact, in your book, leafing through the page here.
That's in there. It's in there.
But there are some mixed messages too. It seems about solar and about like electric cars, for example. That you know, the size of the batteries,
absolutely,
and the cost of replacing them.
Absolutely right. But what she said to this Livermore physicist was, "Your numbers aren't right. There's a gigawatt of power in just a square kilometer of sunlight." And that doesn't take up much more space than a nuclear power plant.
Silence.
It was silence. She called it a delicious silence. And then he finally said, obviously he'd been thinking through the numbers. He said, well, your numbers don't sound wrong. I'm going to have to take another look at that. Yes.
Well, and what would be the reason for that? I mean, do you think, is it that solar is not as, you know, as exciting or as challenging, perhaps, a kind of science as nuclear science?
Oh, I think part of the problem is there's this arrogance among physicists that they're real experts in their field, and then they pick up a lot of their knowledge from things they don't know much about, and they just pass it on as if it's right. This is a case where the physicist, who was so enthusiastic about fusion, just had never actually sat down and worked out the numbers for solar. I'm very optimistic about solar for certain applications. And, of course, as you see in some of the cartoons in the book, I'm very pessimistic for its use in some other applications.
Give us an example of the two.
Well, I think solar power as a major power source to replace coal and fossil fuels, I think is very likely. The price of solar cells has been dropping dramatically, particularly in China and in the developing world, where I think it will quickly become a major power source. On the other hand, even though there's a gigawatt in a square kilometer, there's only a kilowatt in a square meter. And that means you take a square yard of solar cells and put it on your car, and the most you'll get is a kilowatt, and that's only a little bit more than one horsepower. So you want a solar-driven automobile? There's a cartoon about this in the book. Then you have a one-horsepower car, and you'll find a horse and buggy will be hunking you out of the way.
You know, it seems also I asked you about global warming, and let me come back to that question. Like, why is it important, or what is the physics behind global warming you think that it's important for a leader to know about?
Well, I think people need to know that global warming among scientists is not a controversial issue, that we have global warming already, but global warming that we have is what makes the life world livable. Without global warming, we would be below freezing around the whole Earth. When people talk about the dangers of global warming, what they're really referring to is enhanced global warming. It will make it a little bit better. The greenhouse effect, I like to call the car in the parking lot effect. You go to a car that's out in the sun, and you discover it's terribly hot inside. Well, the Earth, the atmosphere, plays that same role, and it warms us up to keep us above freezing, which is absolutely necessary. But we're improving the blanket a little bit, improving it by adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And that so far has given almost a degree Fahrenheit of warming. It's not very much, not enough for anybody to really notice except scientists. But the projections are that with increased carbon dioxide, that this will go up from 1 degree Fahrenheit to maybe 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's what we worry about.
In the book, you have on the left-hand side of each page, there's the physics of this and of a topic. And then on the right-hand side, there's a fun illustration with a little sort of a fun fact. And one here on global warming, there's a cartoon of a scientist putting his thermometer into the earth to take its temperature. And the caption reads, "There has been no significant global warming over the past 12 years." And I can see where some of these little scientific facts get pulled out by people like Glenn Beck or, you know, who doubters of the science, people who are used to sort of who use numbers, isolated facts to dispute theories. I mean, do you worry about that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I am now leading a major scientific research program in Berkeley to do a new evaluation of global warming. And we expect to have some results out within the next few months. We are becoming one of the major teams to do this. I hope we will become the major team. So this is a big effort to get a better measurement out of that. But yes, I mean, the problem is that there are what I would call the deniers, people who just – and they pay no attention to the science. On the other hand, there are also the alarmists who also pay no attention to the science. And this the debate is typically put forth as if it's a debate between the deniers and the alarmists. And now the problem with this is the deniers can show the alarmists are all wrong. They're not paying attention to the science, and it's true. And so someone listens to them and they say, oh, this is all baloney. But then if you listen to the exaggerators, they'll point out the deniers aren't paying any attention. Now, in between, there are some very reasonable people. But that debate doesn't get reported because it's not as fiery as the debate between the extremists.
So where would you put Al Gore?
He is not quite an alarmist. I'd put him as an exaggerator. I mean, the problem, Al Gore, is that he, in some ways, is a national hero for bringing this to the attention of the American people. But the way he did it was not by using the method of science, but by using the method of politics, which was to exaggeration, distortion, cherry-picking, a whole bunch of things. I talk all about this in my previous book, Physics for Future Presidents. So most of what he shows in his movie is actually very misleading. But it served a purpose. Now, my feeling back then when it first came out was that this is going to be a bad purpose because we need to get people's attention to this, but we need to get their attention by giving them the truth and giving them an accurate version of it. When you exaggerate, people are won over and they become passionate. And then they eventually learn they were fooled. And I think we're seeing that in the United States now. We're seeing a backlash of people who are saying, these people are exaggerating. They fooled me. They feel insulted. And then they go the opposite way. I mean, the truth is in between. And I believe people – I think I have more respect for the American public than do either the exaggerators or the deniers.
But is the truth compelling enough to do something about – to compel people to do something or to want to do something about global warming?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. No, we need to do something. But the truth is in the scientific data. As you look at the temperature rise, you can see the temperature rise. When you look at the theory, you see the temperature rise matches the theory. Now you look at the theory, what it projects, and you see that's going to be very bad. So it's compelling, but it's not as emotionally compelling as saying polar bears in the north are dying because or that we're losing the coral reefs or we're losing species diversity in the Amazon. Those things tug at the heartstrings. They're just not true, unfortunately. But they have that emotional impact that charts and graphs of the scientists don't have.
But in the end, perhaps not so helpful to the cause.
Well, that's the problem. You win people over, but if you don't do something quickly, then eventually they find out and people feel burned when they do that. And I've been warning about this ever since An Inconvenient Truth came out.
My guest this hour is Rich Muller. He's a physics professor at UC Berkeley. His new book is called The Instant Physicist, An Illustrated Guide. And let me ask you about these illustrations. Joey Manfree is the illustrator.
Yeah.
What these are sort of fun cartoons. Where did you find him? And did you work with him on your last book?
No. I've known Joey for a while. I met him and he gave me a cartoon of me taking a photograph of a line, which I kept up in my living room. And so when I came up with the instant physicist idea, he was the first person who came to mind. And fortunately, I was able to persuade him to do it. The way we wrote this book would be that I would come up with a paradox, something like you can outrun a tsunami, or that wine and liquor in the United States to be sold legally is required to be radioactive. Now, these are little vignettes that I learned in teaching physics, things that grab people's attention. They wake up the students. The reaction of the typical person is, oh, wait a minute, that can't be true. A little bit like the old Ripley's Believe It or Not. You say, no, that's impossible. So I would give these to Joey, and he would then create a humorous, full-color, beautiful cartoon. I just love his art. I hate to call it a cartoon because it's really a work of art that even draws the attention even more. So the concept of the book is you open up the book to a random page. You see this brilliant, funny cartoon. You read the caption at the bottom and you say, what? No, that can't be.
Well, why don't we do that here?
Okay.
Let's see. Open up here. Okay. Well, this is one you just mentioned. Liquor and wine in the United States must be radioactive to be legal. When tested, drinking alcohol is required to have at least 400 radioactive decays per minute for each 750 milliliters. What's the thinking there?
Right. And the cartoon shows a man preparing a drink, but with full radioactive protective gear on.
And the waitress says, come on, Oppenheimer, they're ready for their cocktails. He's like,
right.
Got protective gear on while he's pouring the cocktail.
See, this is one of those little facts that actually teaches a lot about radioactivity. I mean, first, everybody, this is wonderful. In fact, I was at a dinner party where one of my former students, Alex Mack, he won the Draddy Award, best student athlete in the whole country. And we were at a dinner at the Alumni Association. It's the president of the Alumni Association there, and I'm on his left side, and Alex is on the right side. And he says to Alex, so I understand you took Professor Mueller's course. And I said, yes, I did. So tell me something you remember from it. So Alex looked at him, looked at the glass he was holding in his hand and said, did you know the wine you're drinking is radioactive? And the president went, what? And he said, and it's required to be radioactive by U.S. government. And he said, explain this to me. So here I have this wonderful football player who had taken the course 4 years earlier, but he remembered this was so vivid and it carries so much meaning. So he explained right there in front of me. I've never had a prouder moment for my students. He explained that all living matter, that carbon dioxide, all of living matter is based on plant life. And plant life gets all of its carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And the atmosphere is slightly radioactive because of cosmic radiation coming in. That means all plant matter is radioactive. That means all living things are radioactive at a low level.
Including us.
Including us. And when you find an old bone and you want to know how old it is, you look to see how much radioactivity is left. Because once it stops eating food, then that radioactivity just goes away. U.S. law says that wine, alcohol, beer has to be made from living material. It has to be made from hops. It has to be made from grapes or from grain. You cannot make it from petroleum. That's the law. Why we have that law is another issue, but that's the law. Well, how can you tell? Well, petroleum has been buried underground for hundreds of millions of years. All the radioactivity has gone away. So the only really practical test for determining whether your wine or liquor is your scotch is legal is to test it for its radioactivity. And it's not radioactive, it's illegal.
But who would want to make vodka out of petroleum?
Well, you can make it cheaper. You can make it cheaper, so lots of people would like to do that. And every now and then
they do it in other countries?
And they do. And they do. And when you import that to the U.S., the last case I remember was some wine that came from Italy that was suspect, so they checked its radioactivity. Nope, can't be imported. Illegal.
How does it taste? Have you tasted it?
No, but it tastes fine. There's
can't
no
tell
difference
the difference
in flavor between radioactive alcohol and non-radioactive alcohol.
Yeah. Okay. Here's another cartoon. It's got a woman with blonde hair and no wrinkles coming into the cosmetic surgeon who's got one of these radioactive suits on. And the cartoon caption is, plutonium, often called the most toxic substance known to man, is actually 1,000 times less toxic than Botox, the chemical that people inject under their skin to reduce wrinkles.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Plutonium, there are what I like to think of as physics urban legends, things that people know to be true but ain't so. And one of these is that plutonium is the most toxic substance known to man. This causes great problems with actual policy. When people talk about the dangers of plutonium, yes, plutonium is dangerous. So is a gas stove. So is an automobile. But how dangerous? When you call it the most toxic material known to man, then people react emotionally instead of rationally to it. It's really useful to point this out. Not that plutonium is safe, but Botox is 1,000 times more dangerous. I have a video clip in which Walter Cronkite states, plutonium, known as the most toxic substance known to man. I mean, you know, he was just wrong. He was passing on an urban legend.
But it's really the uses of it that are more dangerous, perhaps, then, isn't it? I mean, terrorists aren't trying to get their hands on Botox.
Well, actually, Botox is so poisonous. Botulism toxin has been used by terrorists to attack cities and to put it in everything from – well, people – they've tried ineffectively putting it in the water supply, but also putting it in food.
Do any of your colleagues ever say, you know, Rich, you're trivializing these important things. You're doing this to entertain people and you're misleading them about one thing or another?
No, they don't. And I think because they recognize that this has real substance. You know, we're not when you're giving people those aspects of physics that are truly relevant to their decisions, to their lives, to deeply understanding things, then that's not trivializing it. There is great substance here. It's just brought in a non-traditional way. Instead of starting with an equation, we start with an anecdote, a soundbite, a humorous cartoon, and then you get to the real substance. But I find if you begin by getting people intrigued, they want to look at it. And they're just like Alex Mack would remember 4 years later because it's vivid and it's meaningful. I find the students at Cal, the class when I took it over, it was then called Physics for Poets, and it had 34 students in it. And by the time I was finished, we were filling up the biggest lecture hall in the university with over 500 students. The students would take it because it was important. And people are drawn to this. They learn things. You don't have to memorize. You don't have to study if you find something really interesting. So this is, if you want to call it a trick, I think it's the oldest trick in teaching.
Is we read a lot about American students falling behind in reading and math, let alone physics.
Yeah.
What difference does it make, do you think?
Well, we live in a high-tech world in which not all the issues, but certainly a large number of them are high technology. Look at alternative energy and the debates on alternative energy where people ask about, well, what about wind? What about solar? What about nuclear? All these things. We're talking about greenhouse warming, and there is this debate going on, but the public is confused about it. About space, going to the moon. Do you just trust your scientists that this is a very valuable thing to do, to go back to the moon? Spy satellites. There's so much misunderstanding. How do we find Osama bin Laden? Why the World Trade Center collapsed? This is something that I lecture on. and people jump to a conspiracy theory because they don't understand the simple physics of what happened at the World Trade Center. So people are misled and they go in the wrong direction and they can't make good judgments on important issues of policy.
And we're going to come back in the second half. We'll talk about Osama bin Laden, maybe a little bit about tsunamis and earthquakes, and maybe even more about global warming. My guest this hour is Rich Muller. His new book is called The Instant Physicist, An Illustrated Guide. If you'd like to ask him a question or pose a theory to him, give us a call. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Dave Iverson. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Dave Iverson. And our guest this hour is Professor Rich Muller. He is a professor of physics at UC Berkeley. His new book is called The Instant Physicist, An Illustrated Guide. And we're talking about all kinds of things, from earthquakes to tsunamis and Osama bin Laden, spy satellites, hybrid cars, global warming. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. A lot of the stuff in this book is about energy, global warming, nuclear power, plug-in hybrids. What does physics tell us about the most efficient use or the most efficient kinds of cars that we're going to have in the next few years?
Well, this is a very contentious issue, and right now there's a great deal of national attention being put on all electric automobiles. When you look at the physics, the engineering, the economics. You cannot separate physics from engineering and economics. Look at what's happening in the high tech. I think a lot of that effort is going nowhere. The batteries that we have are rather expensive. And I've spent some time talking to battery experts all around the world, and they expect the price to come down, but it's not going to drop like solar power prices are dropping. It's going to be rather slow going. And meanwhile, there's something sneaking up on everybody from the side called natural gas. Natural gas is not quite as clean as batteries, although it's just as clean as batteries that are powered by electricity made by coal. But there are huge supplies of natural gas in the United States, and plug-in hybrids really make no sense.
So why is there? I mean, China is doing a big push on batteries and electric cars. So, you know, Chevy, Nissan is coming out with new electric cars. Like, so are they just misguided? Are they not reading the physics?
I think Chevy and Nissan are doing something for public relations. It's a relatively inexpensive form of advertising to look like a good company doing something like that. China is a different case. In China, people don't own cars, and so if you buy them a car that has a range of 80 miles. They're delighted. The issue is whether we can get people in the United States to do that. And that is not just physics and engineering. That's social engineering. And that in the past has proven really tough. You look how hard it has been to get people to use the real money winner, which is energy conservation. And people are very resistant to it. They think it's uncomfortable. They think it slows the economy. There are all sorts of mistaken reasons why people oppose the real winner, which is energy conservation, or even more miles per gallon with current automobiles. So in China, they have an opportunity to use cheap batteries. They could use lead-acid batteries, which are very cheap, and they really do make sense. We could never get away with that in the United States because people would basically object. Well, I'm out of my area of expertise, but I suspect that getting people to widely replace their existing automobiles with ones that go less than 100 miles just will not prove practical.
And what about the hybrids, the Prius and those kinds of cars? Those aren't plug-ins.
The non-plug-in hybrids make a huge amount of sense. I own a Prius. I drive it. I love it. There's a new generation of hybrids coming out. What the hybrid does, batteries are expensive. That's the problem. And they don't carry much energy. You compare a pound of gasoline to a pound of lithium-ion battery. The gasoline has 100 times the energy in it. 100 times. This is what has slowed the electric car. The electric car wasn't killed by a conspiracy. It was killed by the laws of chemistry and physics. So, but in the Prius and in the other hybrid cars, because batteries are so expensive, you use them only when the car is otherwise very inefficient. For example, when it's just accelerating or when it is going downhill. So this is the real secret of the hybrid. But plug-in hybrid, no, that's more expensive.
All right, let's go to the phones now. And Sonny is on the line. Looks like in Cadillac, Michigan. Hello.
Hey, thank you. I think the guest has made a very, very important commentary through this book. It's what he said today in terms of teaching and learning. And that is the importance of teaching students what questions to ask. And, you know, for instance, the student that he referenced with the wine at dinner, that student likely didn't remember the equations or even all of the details that went into that, that the physics of that situation, but he knew the concept. And if he needed to, he could go find the equations, he could find the math, but that concept will stick with him forever, and that's what's important in teaching and learning.
Are you a teacher, Sonny?
No, just a lifelong learner, hopefully.
You should be a teacher. I mean, when you were saying, I had the same reaction. I said, here is someone who really knows how to teach.
All right. I didn't know there was a Cadillac, Michigan. Is that the name of the town?
That's the name of the town.
Do they make Cadillacs there?
No, actually, Cadillacs are made downstate. I don't know where the town got the name.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go now to Caroline, who is in San Francisco. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Mueller seemed to be dismissing outright the idea that global warming threatens such things as polar bears and coral reefs, and I was just hoping he could expand on that, explain why.
Okay. It does threaten them. It threatens them in the next 50 years when we have really substantial global warming. The mistake is to scare people by saying they're already in danger. The IPCC mentions the coral reef danger, but they've been called to task on that because it was not based on any scientific publication. And too much of this official UN report was passing on these anecdotes. In the polar bear case, the movie An Inconvenient Truth was actually brought was going to be distributed to all the high schools in the UK, and a parent brought suit stopping this, saying it's a political movie, not an actual scientific movie. And so a court case over there decided that An Inconvenient Truth could be distributed to every school in the UK, provided that they had a list along with it of 10 basic mistakes in the movie. One of them was the polar bear. I can tell you an incident about the polar bears because a colleague of mine who is much more famous than I am, very high-level scientist in the United States, made a comment about An Inconvenient Truth being full of things that were misleading. And so Al Gore asked him to come and explain what it was that was wrong. And he started by saying, well, take the polar bears. We watch all the polar bears. Aren't that many? We know none have died so far from the retreating glaciers as shown in your movie. Why did you include that? And Gore's answer was, we needed something that would tug at the heartstrings.
Okay, so it sounds like Mr. Gore went too far. I agree, based on what you've said. But as a layperson, the kind of information about the polar bears and coral reefs is what got my attention, and I'm extremely concerned about the issue now. And it sounds like there needs to be a presentation where they're saying, in 50 years, these lives are going to be threatened. I mean, that seems like the middle ground to be walking. But we in the lay public need to be told that they are in danger in 50 years. We can't wait for 50 years and then be told it's too late.
Well, yes, and as I think I made it clear that I'm deeply concerned. What concerns me also, however, is that if instead of presenting the honest case, you present an exaggerated case, then when people discover that it was exaggerated, they feel badly about it. I really respect my audience. I respect my students. I respect the readers of my books. I treat them as if they are thoughtful, intelligent. And when I tell them that according to the measurements, we have a serious problem coming up over the next not just 50 years, but 20, 30, 40 years, that they will pay attention to that and not require these things about these magnificent creatures who will be who are already being threatened.
But your students are not necessarily they're not typical consumers of information about global warming. I mean, maybe the average person, whoever that is, you know, isn't that kind of like to get them into the conversation, you have to do something that may be a little, you know, manipulative.
Yeah, I disagree completely. I think as a teacher, if they will figure it out. The people are smarter than a lot of people give them credit to be. I have much more respect for this audience than does former Vice President Al Gore. They will figure it out, and then you've lost them.
All right.
Caroline, I agree with you completely. Tell the truth and don't. I absolutely support what your approach is. I just think it's still very important to make clear that there is a long-term threat.
I agree completely.
All right,
Caroline. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. 866-733-6786 if you want to talk to Rich Mueller about his book, The Instant Physicist. Let's go now to Berkeley. Kate is on the line. Kate, welcome to Forum.
Hello. First of all, I want to say I think it's a really fine program, and I think maybe I will pass the book along to a couple of grandchildren as Christmas presents. But also on the climate change bit, I mean, I'd like to know if he thinks James Hansen is erring.
Yeah, I've studied James Hansen.
Just to say a little bit more about who
he
is.
Yeah, James Hansen is the leader of one of the three major global warming analysis centers in the world. One of them is in the UK. Hansen leads the program at NASA. And then there's another program at NOAA. We're creating a fourth one here at Berkeley. Hansen does extremely excellent scientific work. Then he likes to go out and make alarmist press releases because of the danger of things that are happening in the distant future. So I love his scientific papers, and I fear that once he gets in front of a newspaper that he says things that are a little bit stronger. He's always, I think, very good in his science.
I was impressed by him and by the fact that he came out in 1970 talking and didn't really continue to talk until he became himself quite alarmed. And I think his alarm alarmed me more than anything he said.
Well, I was alarmed very early, too. It was in 1982 that I first made a major decision based on my fear of global warming. That's when I resigned from the Sierra Club. And in my letter, I told them that in opposing nuclear power, they were going to drive us towards fossil fuels, and that fossil fuels have this danger of an enhanced greenhouse effect. This was in my letter of resignation in 1982. I was very active in the Sierra Club. Backpackers.
Well, I survived there, too.
Yeah, and it was really hard for me to resign, but I felt that they were making a major mistaken shift by identifying nuclear power as the biggest threat when I felt the carbon dioxide and global warming was a big threat.
All right, Kate, thanks so much for the call. We've got an email here from Wendell who writes, "Excuse me, is Richard Mueller listening to himself? He criticizes Al Gore for exaggerating and then tells his audience that he needs to tell his students that wine is radioactive and slightly exaggerate to make a lasting impression."
Well, it's not an exaggeration. I think people need to understand how much radioactivity there is in the world around them. And I wear a radioactive wristwatch. It has a tritium dial in it. I love it. By presenting this as a paradox, why are we worried about radioactivity when it is so much a part of the natural world? People begin to appreciate that they have to think about the numbers. They have to. My students know how much radioactivity it takes to cause cancer, and they know the radioactivity in wine is negligible. But you have to get them interested to do that. It's not an exaggeration. The fact is we are surrounded by radioactivity. And therefore, if there's a small release of tritium from the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, my students will immediately ask, how much? Rather than say, oh my God, radioactivity, this is terrible, let's evacuate Berkeley.
Here's another listener, JP, who writes, if your guest is putting himself forward as an expert, he needs to speak carefully and responsibly, saying that evidence for loss of species due to global warming is okay, but leaving out that species are being lost due to habitat loss is irresponsible.
Well, it's certainly not okay. No, I mean, the species lost in Brazil is certainly a big concern, and it comes exactly as JP says, from habitat loss. All I was saying is that when they attribute that to global warming, they are basically riding on top of another tragedy and trying to attribute it to global warming. And in that case, they're doing harm in both cases. One, they're making a case for global warming that will not hold up. And secondly, they're distracting from the real problem, which is the destruction of the rainforests in Brazil.
Your earlier book, Physics for Future Presidents, to what extent have you given advice to politicians and policymakers, and do they take it in? Because sometimes they need anecdotes and maybe exaggerations or things that are slightly misleading, like Al Gore did.
The things that are misleading, you give them something like that and they use it, and someone points it out to them, it'll never come back to you again. What policymakers need, and yes, I've done a lot of advising to high level policymakers. What they really need is information. I tell this to my students, but it's also true for politicians. You can give someone your opinion, and if you make it a strong opinion, you think you'll persuade them, but you probably won't. But if you give them information, often it's just information going to the people who are already concerned about the problem, such as Al Gore, and give him some information that is really useful and he can pass on. You give high-level people in the Department of Energy insights about what they really can do that will really work. And I think most people are problem solvers. Yes, there's this politics there, but a lot of people really want the legacy of coming back from Washington having really accomplished something. And so if you can inform them, that's the best thing you can do.
Is the media a friend or foe on all this?
The media is essential. I think it, like everything else that is so important, it has its good sides and its bad sides. But I think the media, likewise, likes to present the facts when it can. But they're confused, too. And they need to be educated. People who are in the media often don't know the science and will pass on the urban legends unwittingly. So yes, they are an important. They're the fourth arm of government. They need to be informed too.
Maybe your next book is Physics for Future Journalists. All right, Ben is on the line in Santa Rosa. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
I was listening a bit ago, and I have to take issue with your guest's comparison of gasoline versus a battery, and particularly the notion that a pound of gas has 100 times more energy than a pound of battery. Well, certainly it does, but the gas is gone. It's created pollution. The battery remains to be used. So I have some problems with that comparison.
Okay. No, I mean, what you say is absolutely right. And there are two issues in the United States that often get confused, and they really need to be kept separately. One of them is what we call the energy security issue. Two-thirds of our imbalance of payments goes to buying petroleum from overseas. And we are burning, I think we only have 6 years worth of oil left if we were not to import any. So this is a big national concern, and it drives a great deal of diplomacy and politics. On the other side, we have the fact that gasoline contributes to global warming. However, the numbers there are a little bit surprising when you actually look at them. U.S. has contributed more than its fair share to global warming. Certainly true. The total global warming attributed to humans, according to the UN, is according to this IPCC report, is about half a degree Celsius, half a degree Celsius. Of that, the United States has contributed more than its share, about 0.15 degrees Celsius, basically a sixth of a degree Celsius. How much have our automobiles contributed to that? One quarter of that. So that's 1/24 of a degree Celsius. So yes, we can be really concerned about automobiles. It's not going to address the global warming problem. The real global warming problem comes from the big sources. And okay, we have to pay attention to the little things too, but you have to remember that we also have this energy security and balance of payments issue. And if you forget that, you're not going to persuade people in Washington, D.C. You have to take that into account when making your arguments, because the people in Washington are concerned not just about global warming, but also about energy security and balance of payments.
Worldwide, how big a problem, how big a contributor are vehicles
worldwide, they're still very small. Here's the really bad news. This is unfortunate, but China, even though it produces less energy per person than we do, quite a bit less, is producing a lot more carbon dioxide than the United States is. It's growing at 10% a year, and that's a serious problem. If we cannot somehow reduce the carbon emissions from China and India and the developing world, nothing we do in the United States will have an impact on global warming. It'll have very little impact.
And that's not vehicles. It's more what, factories?
A lot of it's factories and heating and other uses of electric power. You know.
Are you a big advocate of nuclear power? It sounds like you are.
Well, I think nuclear power is dangerous. People used to call it dangerous when oil wasn't. I mean, what's dangerous about oil? Well, now we know carbon dioxide is dangerous about oil. And many people would attribute our wars in the Mideast to the fact that these are oil regions. So the Chernobyl of oil is war in the Mideast and global warming. I think given the fact that none of these things are safe, it's time to take a new look at nuclear power. Nuclear power has gotten a lot safer in recent years, a lot less expensive, it's looking pretty good. It should get another look.
In the book, there's a cartoon about Three Mile Island, I think, and the biggest health effects from Three Mile Island, the meltdown or the nuclear accident in, was it 1980, right around then, 79, 80? But the biggest health impact was mental health.
Absolutely right. I mean, the governor basically panicked around Three Mile Island. He scared so many people that finally, after it was all settled, the Kemeny Commission actually studied the health effects of the released radioactivity, and they concluded there were no negative effects from the released radioactivity. It was far too small, but that there were serious mental health issues caused by the premature panic.
866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Raman is on the line in Menlo Park. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is about energy storage system, because it seems that the energy storage right now is very expensive due to these expensive batteries, and it could present a bottleneck in the technology going forward in that way. So my question is, would it be feasible to have purely physical energy storage systems, such as, for example, compressing massive springs with high spring constants, or perhaps lifting heavy objects, perhaps made out of depleted uranium or whatever, from like a well or something like that.
Go ahead.
Rama, that's an excellent question and something that that the public doesn't seem to be paying much attention to. But when you're talking about wind power and you're talking about solar power, what do you do at night? What do you do when the wind's not blowing? So we talk about energy storage. And some of the things you mentioned, such as you talk about compressing springs, the most efficient turns out to be compressing gas. And there are places in the United States where this has been tried. It turns out to be a little bit too expensive right now. The flywheel idea of spinning very heavy things, probably not uranium, because when you spin something, it has to be very, very strong. And so some of these new carbon fibers may be what you want to spin when you do that. But In the end, I think what's going to happen is we're not going to be using energy storage. Instead, we'll use these huge supplies of natural gas we have in the United States. And when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't out, you light up the natural gas to provide your power. And I think that's going to win simply because it's cheaper, not because it's better, but because it's cheaper.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the call. You suggest in your book that hydrogen, the old hydrogen highway that Governor Schwarzenegger talks about for automobiles, that's not very practical.
Well, it started with a State of the Union message by President Bush, who stated that within a few decades, his grandchildren would be driving hydrogen-driven automobiles. And then Governor Schwarzenegger jumped on that and started making the hydrogen highway. Within a year, everybody had dropped it. No mention in any State of the Union address since then. Governor Schwarzenegger, I think, dropped it even faster because he had a superb scientist engineer in his own energy commission, Art Rosenfeld, who simply pointed out the problems with hydrogen. First, most of it's made from fossil fuels. That's how we get it, burning natural gas or water on coal. So that's bad for the environment. And secondly, storing it in an automobile is really quite hard compared to, let's say, natural gas. If you were to liquefy it, and that's quite dangerous and difficult to do and requires very special gas tanks because it's very, very cold, way below freezing temperature of water. You have to hold it in a thermos. It takes up four times as much space as gasoline. So there are problems there, too. You can do so much better with natural gas. So basically, this is one of these things that because President Bush did a State of the Union message on it, he retracted it. He didn't retract it, but he never mentioned it again.
Kind of like that trip to Mars.
Hmm.
I just want to come back to a couple things we brought up at the beginning. I kind of teased people. I want to bring them back up. Tsunamis. How can you outrun a tsunami if it's going 300 miles an hour?
Yeah. Well, you know, the tsunami goes this fast, and that's the number that can be used to scare people. And unfortunately, if you just scare people by scaring them about tsunamis, you actually might have a loss of life. A tsunami comes very, very fast, but it's not a wall of water, which is the most trite and misleading phrase. A tsunami used to be called a tidal wave because it's like a rising tide. Now, what a tsunami really is a wave, but it's a wave where when you're at the crest, you are basically 10 miles offshore. And it takes, from the trough to the crest, it takes several minutes for that high water to come in. So it behaves like a rising tide, which is why we used to call it a tidal wave.
Why do we stop calling it a tidal wave?
Oh, because people preferred a foreign name. They called it tsunami now. But tsunami actually means harbor wave. So it's not a wave caused by harbors.
My water polo team is called tsunami. We like that. It's better than the tidal wave.
I think it's just because in English we love to have foreign words.
Yeah. So how do you outrun it and win? What's the advice?
Well, the trick is, even though that crest is moving so fast because the tsunami is so gradual. It's not a wall of water. It's a gradual shape. It has waves on top of it. And when the tide rises and comes into your living room, you notice those waves hitting your windows. But it's not a wall of water. And so since it rises, and it may take a couple of minutes to rise to its full height of 30 feet, if you can go up 30 feet, and there are signs all over Hawaii, if you go there, for example, where there are hills near the coast, and they have these tsunami warning sirens, and they have signs, go this way in case of tsunami. And even if the tsunami starts coming, which is often by the withdrawal, by the recession of the water, you see that, just get up to higher ground. Don't outrun it in the same direction it's moving. Run up.
So you can't really outrun it. You're just getting away from it.
You get above it.
Yeah. And then the Osama bin Laden thing and the spy satellites. Why is it that spy satellites will never really help us catch Osama bin Laden or
well,
at least see him?
Spy satellites stay up because they're spinning around the Earth so fast. And if you ever stop them, they'll fall. So it's that centrifugal force that holds it up. By the way, for those of you who are now complaining I'm using a term centrifugal force, let me just tell you, it's a term that we don't use in elementary physics, but in advanced physics, it really is a valid term. The centrifugal force holds it up, and therefore it moves really fast. And we're talking about something that goes around the entire Earth in typically 90 minutes. That means it is above any one location for at most a minute and a half. So you get it's like taking a snapshot. And it won't come back to that same location for another 24 hours. And that's because the Earth is turning. And so it goes around. It comes around the Earth in just 90 minutes, but the Earth has turned a little bit. So it's really hard to observe people from spy satellites. That's why we have so many unmanned drones now that are doing the real spying.
And those are more likely to see somebody who – the point you make in the book is that all he would have to do is sort of get Osama bin Laden or anybody else who wanted to avoid a spy satellite is just sort of get out of the way for a couple minutes.
Yeah, and they just go on the internet to find out when the spy satellites are overhead, which you can do because there are hobbyists who keep track of this and make it public to everybody. And then a minute and a half later, you can come back out of your cave. But with an unmanned drone, an unmanned air vehicle, they can circle around. That's why we're moving in that direction.
All right. Richard Muller, his new book is called The Instant Physicist, an illustrated guide with illustrations by Joey Manfrey. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, very welcome.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Kevin Guillory, and Tina Lauerberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Dave Iverson. Michael comes back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.